groundwork in understanding the age in which we're living. And we are going to be making the shift to the Church of Laodicea, which, as you know, we believe is the age in which we're living in. We're not a member. We're not members of the Church. Is anyone here a member of the Church of Laodicea? Hand in your resignation. Tell them you're not a part of that church anymore. You don't want to be a part of the Church of Laodicea, because the Church of Laodicea is an unsaved church. But we're a part of the Church of Philadelphia. We're the remnant of Philadelphia, living, I believe, in the Laodicean church age. And I got to tell you the absolute truth, friends. I believe that the age of Laodicea is winding down quickly. I believe that we are at the very, very last stages of human history. Now, as we see the way that these things have unfolded, as we've gone through the different periods, we've seen how the church has been the focus all throughout the book of Revelation 2 and 3, chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation. We've seen how the church has been the focus. The letter to the church of Ephesus, dealing with the apostolic age, and then Sardis and the suffering that that church went through, and then the way that the church was polluted during the period of Thyatira and Pergamum, and then how finally we see a light, a glimmer of hope, and then there was Sardis, and then we see a light and a glimmer of hope come through with the Philadelphian church, and all of a sudden the doors are opened, no man can shut them. It's an amazing thing. The missionary movement goes throughout all of the world, and we're not going to spend time talking about some of those missionaries because of time, but now all of a sudden we enter into the darkest period of the history of the church, and it will end up being the final period of history of the church. And as the Lord writes to this church, we have to remember that it's the only church that the Lord writes to with which he cannot find one positive thing to say. There's nothing, because anything positive about this age is a remnant from the Philadelphian age. Do you hear what I'm saying? Everything that's positive about the age in which we're living today is left over from the age of Philadelphia. And there's not one thing that the Lord has to commend. This is the church that pictures Jesus Christ on the outside of the church knocking and asking to come in. This is the church that is neither hot nor cold. This church has a form of godliness. This church is in the deep throes of apostasy. And so, before we can understand what the lay, before we can just jump into this book, and that would be what I'd love to do, but I wouldn't be doing justice to the scriptures, because we've got to try to figure out intellectually, how did we get from Philadelphia to Laodicea? How did the shift take place? And that shift has taken place on a number of different planes, and I wrote some of them down today and worked with them a little bit, and I want to introduce you to some ideas, and some of it may be like, hey, just forget about it. Let it go. Listen, pick up what you can. And I do think it's important, though, if we're going to be thorough and understand how the shift took place. Now, in the age of Philadelphia, we have this beautiful idea of the church being able to go anywhere in the world, the church being on fire, wanting to run out and preach the gospel to everyone that they can find. The Lord had nothing negative to say about the Church of Philadelphia. And just as with the Church of Sardis, it was a really wonderful thing. But now, all of a sudden, we've gone from this age where the Christian experience was so meaningful and so deep, to all of a sudden, everybody's still in church, but the experience, the genuine experience of what Christianity is gone. How did it happen? What happened? How did God go from being so important to being dead? I mean, God is dead. That's what remember the Elton John song commenting on this? Elton John had a song about someone named Levon. I never understood the song. But remember he had this chorus. He said, he was born on a Christmas Eve when the New York Times said God is dead and the war's begun. Leon Capslinger has a son today. Now, characterizing the age, Elton John is saying, you know what? This kid was born on a Christmas Eve when the New York Times, one of the most important newspapers in the world, was announcing that God is dead. So we need to take a look at some of this philosophy. This whole thing's not going to be about philosophy. Oh, no, it'll be about literature and art and poetry, and you're going to love it. But I put it together, and I really struggled with it. I want to tell you, I really struggled with whether or not to present it at all. I'm going to leave it with you. I'm going to teach what I'm going to teach, and I'm going to leave it with you. If it blesses you, I think it's going to enlighten your understanding of where we are today. If not, just leave it, and we'll be moving on shortly. What I want to do tonight is I want to try to show you the background to the Laodicean period. I want to try to define for you how the paradigm shift happened. Why did we go from one model, which was basically a theistic model? God was in charge. God was widely believed in. People had reverence for God. The average person cared about God, believed that God had created them, to coming to a place where God is on the outside. And any worship that we have is really superficial. You have to imagine this with me for a moment. The vast majority of churches that gather on a Sunday morning in the year 2002, the vast majority of those churches that gather, there is no real, deep, intimate relationship with the divine. In most cases, if they're anything like me, and I know that many, many, many are, when I was going to a Catholic church, I was going to assuage a guilt complex. And it was good that they had the Saturday evening service so I could get in, get out, and party. I certainly didn't want to get up early to go to Sunday morning service. I mean, this is how I was. I grew up a Roman Catholic. Now, when we went to Greece, Greece is a Christian country. We lived there on and off for a period of 3 years, and we were shocked at what we found. You know what we found? We found the same spirit that we left here, only with a different name, Greek Orthodoxy. Nobody really lived that faith that we knew. They all had their icons on the wall, and, you know, unlike the Catholics, they don't pray to statues, they pray to pictures. The Orthodox Church prays to icons. And the Catholic Church prays to, well, technically they'll say they don't pray to the statue, they pray to the saint through the statue, right? Or they pray to the Lord or whatever through the statue. But the idea is they're using these images. And the Orthodox Church, instead of, they say, no, you can't do that. You can only use pictures. So they use pictures. And both of them keep relics, and both of them have, you know, the remains of the saints being very important. And we found an absence of any real meaningful faith. And when the Lord comes back, what is he going to find? What is the Lord going to find going from church to church to church to church? One writer said that if the Lord returned today, he would barely recognize the faith that he founded. That if the Lord came back, what happened to that community of brothers and sisters that got together, really cared about one another's needs, got together around the word, around eating, fellowshipping, praying? What happened? By and large, as church history progressed, it turned into liturgy, sharp distinctions between the clergy and the laity, until we've come to the place today where it barely resembles what we find in the New Testament. We got it back for a little while. Between the 1700s and the 1900s, we got it back for a little while in the period of Philadelphia. But now we've got a problem. Because we enter into a period that's so dark that everyone that is a member of this church, everyone that is a member of the Church of Laodicea, is going into the tribulation. All those who are alive, professing Christians, professing to believe that Jesus died for their sins, all of those who are on the earth at that time are going into the time of the tribulation. It's an awful thing. Where did the shift take place? Well, as I began to think about this, obviously we need to deal with the theological shift, but I'm going to save that for last. And I want to deal with some things that were happening throughout the world on an intellectual, historical, scientific, all of these different disciplines were seeing amazing changes. And so let's kind of walk through and try to see. Now, remember, we said that the major shift happened right about 1900. What got the world ready for that major shift? What made things change? A man was born in 1809 and died in 1882. And he was a biologist, spent a lot of his time collecting specimens and wrote some very influential books, The Voyage of the Beagle, and most importantly, what? The Voyage of the Beagle. No, that's not. It's not Snoopy. It's not the Snoopy thing. But The Voyage of the Beagle is the ship that Charles Darwin was on, you know, going around picking up specimens, and the and eventually he wrote a very important book called The Origin of the Species in 1859. The Origin of the Species is a very, very technical book, very technical. It was received very warmly by the community of biologists when it was first published. You all know what it says. It talks about something called survival of the fittest, that in nature, the fittest or the strongest end up surviving, and the weakest end up being wiped out by the strongest. From Darwin is going to come this whole idea that man wasn't created by God, but man evolved through a process of mutation and through a process of the survival of the fittest, one species dominating another. Man is going to eventually evolve as the king of the jungle. We're going to be the biggest beasts in all of the world, the most intelligent beast, the smartest beast, the strongest beast. We're going to rule the world. Now, this came at a beautiful time because, remember, we're only 40 years now away from the year 1900 when this book is released. It's not going to really hit its level of notoriety that it's going to ultimately receive until much, much later, the early 1900s. In fact, in America, who knows when the Scopes trial was? Was that 1920s? All right, the Scope trial was in 1920. So you've got this whole idea of this science teacher, you know, saying, I'm going to teach Darwin, and the people in 1920, as late as 1920, are still coming out and saying, you can't teach that in a public school. We believe that God created man, and that man is not, we haven't evolved from monkeys, this kind of thing. So there's a major change scientifically. Charles Darwin comes along, and Charles Darwin begins to talk about this idea of natural selection. T.H. Huxley, who comes a little bit later, is also a biologist, taken by this kind of stuff. The thing with Huxley, though, is Huxley begins to write about theology as well. So Huxley is going to talk about not only biology, but how biology impacts theology. Did you pick that up? Huxley's dates are 1825 to 1895, and he coins a phrase that we still use today. First time this word had ever been used, he coins this frame. He coins this phrase, agnosticism. What's agnosticism? It comes from a Greek word that means to know, and the A means not to know. So the word agnosticism means that we can't really know if there's a God. So we go from everybody believing that there's God, or if you don't, you just keep quiet about it because you're way on the fringe. To all of a sudden, well, because of these scientific facts that we've found, these species that we've picked up, let's think this through again. We're not going to come right out and say there's no God, but we're going to say we don't know that there's one. Agnosticism. Someone tells you they're an agnostic, it simply means that they're saying you can't know one way or another whether there is a God. And then finally, we're going to begin to hear about origins, theories of origin in the universe. I'm not going to go through all these because they're very technical, the steady state theory and different theories, and we've talked about them before in the pastor school in different places. But basically what we're going to see is man trying to come up with how the universe could have come into existence without a God. We were talking in our class the other day. Pastor Steve did a great job in the class we had upstairs on Sunday morning, Know Why You Believe. We were talking about whether or not we can know that there's a God. And we said, you see this lid on the top of this coffee cup? If I told you that this coffee cup was the result of a random explosion at a plastic factory, and the molecules of that plastic brought itself into that kind of configuration, it had no designer, no plan, no architect, you'd say you're crazy. No purpose. If I told you there is no purpose, I don't want to take that off. If I said there's no purpose for this pen, it is completely the result of an accident. No designer, nobody architected this pen. Nobody sat down and said, I got to come up with something that I can use to draw. We would say that is completely bonkers. But yet that is what the scientific community, right around the turn of the century, begins to tell us, the world, that we should believe. That man is the result of an accident. A molecule laying on the lunar landscape, lifeless. Or protoplasm, electronic protoplasm, zapped by electricity, and all of a sudden comes to life. From that amoeba or small or you know, single cell or very basic life form comes more sophisticated life forms, until every kind of plant, bird, fish, animal, bird, and human finally evolved through a system of natural selection and mutations. Now listen, you ever feel like you're being hoodwinked? Needless to say that you can't take that molecule in an experiment. You know, according to the scientific method, you can either observe something in nature or you can experiment and you can find, do an experiment in a controlled situation and you can prove something. So I come up with a theory. I come up with a theory that you can make a living thing out of a non-living thing. So I take my rock. We all agree that my rock is non-living. Right? Today, who knows what we agree on, but I believe that the rock is non-living. And I take the rock into a laboratory, and I say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to zap the rock with electricity, and I'm going to wait for the rock to come to life. And I zap it and zap it and zap it and zap it and zap it, and what do I end up with? A hot rock. No life, right? Okay, so here's what I do. Here's what I do. Now listen, I'm an intelligent scientist. I'm no fool. I am listening to Francis Bacon's scientific method, and I got to do this right. So in the controlled environment of my laboratory, I couldn't make the rock come to life by zapping it with electricity or any other thing, you know, milk carton, choose anything you want that's dead. So you know what I do? I'm not done. My hypothesis, which is a fancy word for guess, my hypothesis is not dead in the water yet. I can still go out in nature and try to observe living things coming from non-living things. You know what I find? Nothing. No evidence. So if I'm an intelligent, rational, honest scientist, you know what I've got to do? Throw my hypothesis away and come up with a new one. Why hasn't it been thrown away then? Well, Jack can tell you that scientists are jumping off the evolution bandwagon just about as fast as they can get them on these days. I mean, the whole evolution thing is really being rethought through, because all of a sudden they're finding all of the gaps in it, you know, no transitional species. You know, the idea is that the fish became the reptile, the reptile became the bird became the problem is they've never found any fish bird. They've never found any, you know, we talk about a missing link. There are all kinds of missing links. There are links broken everywhere. There's no fish, bird. There's no man, monkey. We're trying to find the missing link between monkeys and man. We haven't found that. But there's a lot more missing links. A lot of links are broken. You know why? Because in the beginning, God created them and he told them to reproduce after their own kind. And that's what they did. So all of a sudden now, for the first time, the intellectual world has really bought the idea that there just may not be a God. They like this because they want to live like hell. And if you have a God in the picture, you have to be accountable to that God. So now all of a sudden, we've got another problem. Never mind the monkey man business, and never mind mutation, and never mind all that. Oh, how are we going to do this, by the way? How are we going to make this work? Easy. Well, the way that we're going to make that one cell become all these different species is with what? Who knows? A long time. It's going to take a long time for this to happen, right? Okay, just so that we all know. Then we have to come up with the origin of the universe, or cosmology, because we've got to figure out, if there is no God, where does everything come from? Now, I know that I've shared this before, but I have no better illustration than this. I was watching McNeil Lahr NewsHour. I don't even know if they're still on, but they used to be on PBS, and they used to have a pretty good news program. And they had an astrophysicist on there trying to explain the Big Bang Theory to idiots like me, sitting home eating macaroni and cheese off of one of those little card table deals. So, here I am, Joe Public, right? And he says, why don't you explain how this happened? He goes, well, very condescending, by the way, but imagine that the whole universe, now, think with me for a moment. We live on a planet. That planet is a part of a solar system because it goes around the sun. That solar system is a part of, according to Carl Sagan, billions and billions and billions and billions of solar systems in this one galaxy. You see all the stars up in the sky at night? Every single star that you see is a part of our galaxy, the Milky Way. And we're told that our galaxy is one of billions and billions and billions of galaxies in the universe. Now, you know what the technical word for this is? Big. That's big. This is huge. Big stuff. Now, think about this for a moment, all right? This guy says, imagine, Jim, that the whole universe, that means all the galaxies with all the billions of solar systems inside the galaxies and our little planet, were squeezed into a little dot, the size of a dot on your television screen. Jim goes, yeah. He goes, there'd be a lot of pressure, huh? I'm sitting home with my macaroni and cheese thinking, yeah, that's a lot of pressure. That is a lot of pressure. And he goes, well, is it any wonder why it exploded? Do you know that that's what the Big Bang Theory essentially says? And because of the speed with which it, you know, this kind of thing, the speed with which it came at you, you know, and the way that things happened, things kind of coalesced the way that they did and kind of formed the way that they did really quick. And here's this rock, third rock from the sun, and we get caught in the gravitational pull of a moderately sized star, which we call the sun. Now, if you can believe that, friends, you can believe anything. That is just sheer foolishness. But that is exactly what the Big Bang Theory is all about. Now, you know what we asked when we were up in the room the other day? We said this. Okay, let's say we buy your whole universe squeezed into a dot theory. Who made the dot? We're still where we left off, right? We still have a dot, and somebody had to make the dot. Do you know anything that exists that wasn't brought into being by somebody? So, we see a major shift as we approach the year 1900 in biology, which is going to explain the origin of the species, where we came from. We're one of those species. And also, cosmology. God said in Genesis chapter 1 that he made the heavens and the earth, just like that, in a moment in time. Not in 7 days, instantly. We've already covered that. And in 7 days, the earth was restored from a cataclysm of Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. So we see some changes taking place in science. At the same time, changes are taking place in philosophy. Now listen, believe me, I can pitch a tent here, but I'm not going to. I'm going to have some mercy. I heard you saying, mercy, mercy. I'm not gonna do it. But let me just talk about a couple of things quickly. Things that I think really impact this the idea of the change of models as we go into the 1900s. Remember, we're about to change ages. God says we're about to change ages. We're about to step into the age where nothing good can be said about the church that exists there. How did we get there? Well, philosophically, first of all, let me mention Soren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard is known as the father of modern existentialism. Kierkegaard was a lovely guy. I mean, he is really one of my heroes. He's a tremendous, tremendous man. He had a deep anxiety within him, and he wanted to work it out. He wanted to work it out before God. And you know what he was blown away by? He was blown away by the absurdity of life. Ever get that way? Ever get to the point where you wonder why? What's it all about, Alfie? Remember? Alfie, what is it all about? And you get to the point where you just really, well, he lived in this kind of malaise, and he couldn't get past it. He had a lovely girl that he wanted to marry, and he ended up, he couldn't do it. He was just in a real funk about the purpose of life. He's known as the father of Christian existentialism. He's living pretty early, too, by the way. He's born in 1813, and he dies by 1855. But he begins, his writings are extremely influential, Either Or, Fear and Trembling, extremely influential books. They're basically his diaries of everything he's going through or his thoughts about what he's going through. Kierkegaard says life is absurd. It makes no sense. You're born, you go through life, you find somebody that you like. Hopefully they like you. If they don't, you pay them to like you and marry them anyway. And you get some little kids, and you do the best you can to rear the kids, and along the way you finish your education because we all want to be smart. We do the best we can. We accumulate a lot of things. By the end of our lives, we have a little bit of money, and then we die. Isn't that funny? He didn't find it funny either. He was like, "This is absurd. Life is absurd. What's the point of it all?" So you know what he did? Here's what he did. Kierkegaard said, we have to find a reason to validate our existence. And that reason for me is God. So, now I like that. Do you like that? In other words, he says, do you agree that he's right? If God is taken out of the equation, life is pretty crazy. It's totally absurd. Why should we go through the motion of all these things if, like, when we die, we it's all over. It's finished. So the existential, when you hear the word existentialism, which is a whole bunch of syllables put together, right, to confuse us, the word existentialism is focusing upon our existence and what is important about life and why should we go through the absurdity of life. The key point with all existentialists is absurdity. Now, the later existentialists are not going to find God as their reason. They're going to find other things. And they're basically going to say, Ernest Hemingway, for example, is an existentialist. Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, these are the great, existentialists of the 20th century, the 1900s. We're going to find with these guys, they're going to come up with other reasons. But Kierkegaard, who's the father of them all, is going to say life is crazy, and if you take God out of the picture, life makes no sense at all. It's completely absurd. So we've got this idea of existentialism coming. Existentialism is a reversal of the Platonic ideal. Plato said that, this is a little tricky, it'll just take me a minute and then I'm going to move. So if you don't like it, just nod out for just a second and I'll tell you when I come back in, okay? Now listen, Plato said that essence precedes existence. In other words, the essence of a thing is more important than the actual existence of the thing. In other words, the objective is more important than the subjective. That didn't seem to help either. Did it? A little bit? Okay. All right. Okay. So, though some of you got it, some of you didn't. Listen, if you got it, just hang on to it for a minute. The existentialists reversed it, and they said existence is more important than essence. What I'm doing in my life right now is more important than any overarching idea of, life. This is forms, essences, ideas, prototypes, and all of this Platonic stuff. So we're not going to go there. But existence, just say this, existentialism focuses on existence. Well, as we enter into the 1900s, God doesn't become important anymore. The fact that God's behind everything doesn't matter as much anymore. What matters is, what am I doing right now? My existence. How am I validating my life? It's not about God. It's not about God's plan for my life. It's about me and my plan for my life. Do you see how that kind of worked out? The existentialists were brilliant, too. You know what they did? Rather than writing huge, thick philosophy books, you know what they did? They wrote stories. They wrote stories. Ernest Hemingway picked up a pen and wrote book after book after book that our kids read in school, and rightly they should because they're great pieces of literature, that are existential pieces of literature. How many ever read The Old Man and the Sea? How many got to the end of it and said, huh? How many got to the end of it and said, they didn't teach him there's supposed to be an ending to a book? Okay, let me tell you. Here's The Old Man and the Sea. There's an old man. This old man wants to catch a marlin, right? Is it a marlin? I think it's a marlin. He wants to catch a marlin. Okay. So he's after this marlin, Ray. He's got this thing in him. I'm going to get that marlin. If it kills me. His whole life, he just wants a marlin. This is his purpose in life. Get the purpose? Get the purpose thing happening? Okay. He's going after the fish. So he gets in his rowboat. He's going after the fish. I'm trying to remember. I think he's got a sail at first, and he ends up having to use the sail. I mean, you know, the whole book, which isn't very long, 120 pages or so, he's in the boat. Going after the fish. Hooks the fish. He's got him. He's fighting the fish. You know, now we're 50 pages in. He's got it. He's got the thing, and he's got the bow bands. There's a bend in the string and everything, and he's probably lost his worm, but he's got the thing. I don't think you go for marlin with worms. That's how much of an angler I am. But let me see if I can give you a different angler on it. Now, he finally hooks the marlin, but he's fighting the thing, and that thing's dragging him out to sea. And he knows that there's a certain point that you get out to sea that you can't come back. But he wants this fish. A marlin is a fish, right? Okay, no, I know it is. The whale is what confused me. All right, now watch this. So finally, he gets out so far, he hooks the thing, but he knows he's gone too far. And he ties the thing up to the side of his boat, and he begins making his way back. And the journey kills him. He's on his deathbed by the time he returns. And by the time he gets there, you know what's left of the marlin? Only a skeleton, because all the fish have eaten the dead marlin that's been tied to the boat. That's how the story ends, friends. Now, what's the point? What is the point to that story? Well, it's very easy. Think about it. Well, think about what we just talked about with existentialism. Life is absurd. You spend all your life going after the thing you want, and when you get it, It's useless. It's nothing. You kill yourself trying to get it, and when you get it, and the kids read it. My kids just got done reading it. She didn't understand it. She understood it less after the teacher explained it. But that's existential literature. Now, you know what happened? Where the old philosophers had failed writing these big, thick, being in nothingness, okay? Here's Friedrich Hegel. Hegel says, There are two kinds of everything hope. That's not going to work. Let's see if we can do this. No, we're going to be without this tonight. That's all right. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Let me just see if I can. No. All right, that's all right. Well, it's not that important. He says, listen, everything has a thesis, and this is the old guys, you know. He says, everything has a thesis and everything has an antithesis. In other words, there's a thesis, there's a principle, there's a thing, and that gets acted upon by its anti or by its opposite. So you have life and death, conflicting, coming up, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The two work themselves out into a synthesis, okay? Now, he begins the book by saying, you have life or being. Oh, this is all on the first page of this book that we wouldn't want to lift a lot of times. We begin with being and non-being. What's the synthesis? Confusion say, huh? No, you have being, that's existence, and you have non-being, that's non-existence. Thesis, antithesis, what's the synthesis between the two? It's very brilliant. Becoming is the synthesis. Becoming, okay? Now, from there, that's where the book starts. How many people want to run out and pick up a copy and figure out where he goes with this? All right, but see, what the existentialists did was when we got into the 20th century, we're making the shift, okay? Life is absurd. We're talking a lot about life being absurd. So you've got geniuses like Hemingway sitting down with a pen and writing a story about how life is absurd and letting people figure it out for themselves. Books like this, I brought one Hemingway book, Death in the Afternoon, which is all about bullfighting. This book is unbelievable. This is almost every page is underlined, you know, in my copy. This is one of the finest books ever written in my mind. I mean, secular books ever written. But in between talking about bullfighting, there are these essays about death. Why? Death in the Afternoon is all about the man versus the beast, and only one of them are walking out of the arena alive. You see? So the existentialist thing is happening. And then finally, and last thing we're going to say about philosophy, and it's so important to us, a guy is born, got to spend a little bit of time with him, a guy is born in 1844 and dies in the year 1900. He dies the year that the century changes, at the age of 54. Brought up in the Prussian town of Roken, he was raised in a pious home. His dad was a Lutheran minister. Both granddads were ministers. And for a while, it seemed that he would follow in his father's steps into the ministry, but he abandoned the idea because he really loved languages and wanted to study linguistics and philology, the origin of languages. He studied for a while at the famous Skulptforta, and then at the University of Bonn and the University of Leipzig. He was an absolutely brilliant student of philology, and in 1869, he was offered the professorship at the University of Basel before he had even earned his degree. He accepted the position. He was 24 years old. But his academic career was interrupted by the Franco-Prussian War. He went into the war, and he served as an ambulance driver. And as a nurse, he saw man after man after man blown to bits and dying, crying out in agony. And it was during this time that Friedrich Nietzsche lost his faith in God. He no longer believed that there was a God. Now, Nietzsche is going to become very important because Nietzsche is the one who says God is dead, and we have killed him. Now, he dies in 1900, okay? His entire life was plagued with poor eyesight and migraine headaches. The next 10 years, he spent traveling from one health resort to the next throughout Switzerland, France, and Italy. He tried to recover and wrote prolifically while he did. He pursued many philosophical concepts, the significance and sophistication of which are still being discussed by and debated by scholars on the academic level. He had a great admiration for Wagner, Richard Wagner, the great opera writer who wrote Das Nibelung and Parsifal and The Flying Dutchman. But he had a problem with Parsifal, and he had a big run-in with Wagner because of it, because he said it was too Christian, too many Christian sentiments. And, of course, Wagner is a great anti-Semite, hated the Jews. In January of 1889, toward the end of his life, he became mentally ill, probably as a result of venereal disease. He never recovered from his mental breakdown and spent the last 11 years of his life hopelessly insane. He was cared for by his sister Elizabeth until his death in 1900. Now, during this time, he came up with a philosophical concept. You've got to follow this, and I've got to teach it, because this is going to be one of the major things that are going to cause the shift from God to godlessness. He came up with a philosophical concept called nihilism. Nil means nothing. It means nothing. And what he means by that is that there is no objective ground for one viewpoint to be right over another viewpoint. There is no reason why your view should be right over my view. And he wrote a book called Beyond Good and Evil. And in this book, he said that Christianity had defined these two words, good and evil, incorrectly. According to this Christ, according to the Christians, weakness is good. Meekness is good. In fact, the meek will inherit the earth. They follow a Savior who was crucified in abject weakness upon a cross. And they say that this is good. We ought to be like them. Meanwhile, if you're strong, bold, assertive, powerful, domineering, confident, you're bad. And he says in his book Beyond Good and Evil that we have to go beyond our definitions of what the Christians say good and evil is and come up with new definitions. Now, he writes a number of books, Thus Spake Zarathustra, in which he fictionally puts words into Zarathustra's mouth. Zarathustra is the prophet of the Zoroastrians, the Persian religion. And he says a lot of things. But the point that we need to understand is that if all values are gone, if there's no objective thing with which my view is better than your view, or your... Okay, I think that you should not run people over with your car. Okay, that's what I think. I don't drive like that, but I think that. That's how I think. Now, somebody else comes up and says, well, I do think we ought to run people over with our cars. According to Friedrich Nietzsche, there is no objective ground that makes your opinion right and his opinion wrong. Okay? Now, if there's no values, who has to die? Well, who's constantly shoving values down our throats? God. So he writes a little parable. And this little parable, or this little story, is in The Joyful Science, published in 1882. And he illustrates the death of God in a parable that he calls the madman. I'm going to read it to you right now in total. And you're going to see an absolutely brilliant writer, there's no question about it, who's going to ask some very important questions. Now that he's killing God, he realized there are ramifications. But remember, the world is going into the 20th century with the death of God. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours and ran into the marketplace crying incessantly, I seek God, I seek God? As many of those who do not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. Why, did he get lost, said one? Does he lose his way like a child, said another? Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Has he emigrated? Thus they yelled and laughed, and the madman jumped into their midst. Notice, the madman, the nut, jumps into their midst and pierced them with his glances. Whither is God? Where? Where is God? He said, I shall tell you. We have killed him. You and I, all of us are his murderers. And how have we done this? How are we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us a sponge to wipe away the whole horizon? See what this nut, this madman is saying? He's saying, if there's no God, how do we wipe away the sunset? Doesn't that point to God? More than this. Watch. What did we do when we unchained the earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we all moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward, in all direction? Is there any up or any down or any left? Are we not all straying as if in an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of an empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not the night and more night coming on all the wild? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? God's to decompose. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? What was holiest and most powerful of all, that which the world has owned, has bled to death under our knives, who will wipe this blood off of us? Isn't that an interesting question? In other words, if we've killed and there's no God who's atoned for our sins, who removes the blood from our hands now? The madman goes on to say, who will wipe this blood off of us? And where is the water from which we will cleanse ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games must we now invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too much for us? Must now we ourselves become gods to seem worthy of it? Oh, yes. If God is dead, then man is God. There has never been a greater deed, and whoever will be born after us for the sake of this deed will be a part of a higher history than all history hitherto. Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. And at last he threw his lantern to the ground, and it broke and went out. I come too early, he said. My time has not yet come. This tremendous event is still on its way. And from this little parable of the called the madman from the Joyful Science, Friedrich Nietzsche laid out the philosophy that would characterize the 20th century. Listen, friends, if you're going to murder your babies, you've got to murder God first, or you won't be able to live with the deed. If you're going to live any way you want, you've got to kill God, because God's not going to stand idly by and let it happen. So Friedrich Nietzsche becomes the third important change in philosophy. And listen to what Francis Schaeffer had to say about Nietzsche. In his book, The Church at the End of the 20th Century, written in 1970, 15 years before his death, Schaeffer said this. Nietzsche was the first man who cried in a modern sense that God is dead. But he was brilliant enough to understand the results. If God is dead, then everything is gone. I believe that it was not just venereal disease in Switzerland which caused him to become insane. I believe that Nietzsche made a philosophic statement in his insanity. He understood that if God is dead, there are no answers to anything, and insanity is the end. This is not too far off from the philosophy of Michel Foucault, who, for example, says that our only freedom is truly insanity. Listen to Malcolm Muggeridge, the great philosopher, former editor of Punch magazine, who became a Christian, a Catholic at the end of his life, brilliant writer. And by the way, anything you can find by him, read. Anything that you find by him, read. He's ennobling. He said, if God is dead, then somebody is going to have to take his place. It will be megalomania or erotomania, the drive for power or the drive for pleasure, the clenched fist or the phallus, Hitler or Hugh Hefner. Ravi Zacharias, in his book A Shattered Visage, The Real Face of Atheism, 1990, writes this. He describes the logical outworking of the philosophy of Nietzsche when he says this. In a sense, Nietzsche was the first Western philosopher to face up fully to man's loss of faith in religion. In pronouncing the death of God, Nietzsche not only stepped into the eye of the storm, but he went further and admitted that the storm clouds were even more devastating and violent than any of God's undertakers could have imagined. The consequences of the death of God would penetrate every avenue of life. In fact, Nietzsche went on to say that because God had died in the 19th century, there would be two direct results in the 20th century. First, he prognosticated that the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in history. And boy, has it been. Two world wars. And also, And second, that universal madness would break out. More people have been killed in this century than any other century in history, and by some calculations, more than all previous 19 centuries put together. What is ironic about Nietzsche's statement about universal madness is, with almost symbolic power and a self-fulfilling prophecy, he took the first step and went insane himself. So, you can see where we are. Now, what's going to happen with Nietzsche's philosophy? A guy by the name of Adolf Hitler is going to listen very carefully. By the way, there's a very famous picture of Hitler putting a wreath of flowers on Nietzsche's grave. I don't know if you've ever seen that. But the idea is, here's Nietzsche. Nietzsche says the world is for the strong. He's going to take this idea of natural selection and say that the proud, the strong, have a right to dominate the weak. We have to reverse the definition of good and evil. We have to change things around. This idea of emaciated Christianity, weak, humble, forbearing, fruits of the Spirit, that's for the birds. He says, when brought up against the idea that hundreds of thousands of people died in the French Revolution, you know what he said? The French Revolution produced Napoleon, and that is its justification. Now, Nietzsche has the idea of a superman, a man who's powerful, strong, and can dominate those who are around him. And the strongest should survive. Edmund Spencer's going to take it. Herbert Spencer is going to take it a little bit further, and he's going to develop a theory called social evolution, where he's going to take Darwin's ideas of the survival of the fittest and say it ought to be the same among humans and among nations. Well, Adolf Hitler is going to pervert Nietzsche's ideas, as if they weren't perverted enough, of the strong individual, and he's going to turn it into an idea of the strong super race. And he's going to set out putting Nietzschean philosophy into operation to exterminate the Jews, to exterminate the blacks, and to exterminate the retarded, the weak, the challenged, those that can't work. Why? Survival of the fittest. There is no God. Hitler had no one to be accountable to. Do you see why, maybe, and we got 12 minutes left, do you see why it's important that we said the things that we're saying tonight? Because we've got to make the shift. How do we get from Philadelphia to God saying, I've got nothing to say, I've got nothing to commend you for? A couple other things as we finish up. Psychology. Sigmund Freud is coming out around this time. You know Siggy. Sigmund and the Sea Monsters made more sense than that guy. Sigmund Freud, 1856 to 1939, came up with the idea of psychoanalysis. Everything with him was about sex, obviously. The Interpretation of Dreams, one of his first and important books, about how, you know, all these dreams that we have are like, you know, little glimpses into the subconscious. We can see what's really going on. Freudian slip. You sit there and you pay some psychoanalyst big money so that they can listen to you talk. Do you know what they're listening for? Do you know what these guys are listening for? Do you know what psychoanalysis is all about, right? A lot of psychologists don't believe in Freudian psychoanalysis anymore. But do you know, what are they looking for? Does anybody know? They're looking for the mistakes you make. They're called Freudian slips. Like they're going to, you say, oh, it rains out. I hate it when my, instead of saying, I hate it when my head gets wet. I hate my mother. I don't know why I said that. Oh, he does. The cauldron of your subconscious was opened for a minute, and what's deep down inside came out just for a minute. You guard it well. And through just listening to you talk over and over and over again, year after year after year, finally you're going to slip. And they're going to get to what's going on. The Oedipus complex. Every little girl falls sexually in love with her father at a certain age of development. If she doesn't resolve it right, she's going to be unbalanced. Every little girl, did I say that right? Every little girl falls sexually in love with her father. Every little boy falls sexually in love with his mother and sees his father as an enemy who he needs to kill. If he doesn't resolve it right, there's going to be big problems. This is the Oedipus complex and the Electra complex. Am I making this up? Is there anyone that's heard this before? Okay. But I want you to see something. These are the things going into the 20th century that are going to set the stage for God disappearing. Sigmund Freud. And then later, B.F. Skinner, behaviorism. Man is basically, this is a Harvard guy, man is basically a machine that can be trained to do anything. Puts his own kid in a box as an experiment called the Skinner box to try to train his behavior, you know, really unethical. Literature. All of a sudden, literature is going to take a twist. You know, we have this great stuff by guys like Charles Dickens. All of a sudden, in the 1800s, we're going to begin to hear from guys like Fyodor Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky writes Crime and Punishment, which is one of his most important books, The Brothers Karamazov, The Idiot, The Possessed, Notes from the Underground. In this book, it's shocking. I remember reading this in the Navy. Shocking. Within the first, I bookmarked it, I won't be able to read it to you, but by page 66, Raskolnikov, his antagonist, kills an old cleaning woman with an axe for no reason at all. And the absurd is coming in. Now listen, it's still early. This is the mid-1800s, so by the time we get to the end of this book, Raskolnikov is kissing the ground and asking for redemption. But that's going to go the way of the sparrows. We start to hear from Dostoevsky. Later on, 20th century, Albert Camus writes this book, L'Étranger, The Stranger. He writes La Peste, which is the plague. He writes L'Homme de Révolté, The Revolt of Man. And many of these little books, okay? Let me read something to you here for a moment. He's walking down the beach one day, for no reason whatsoever, and he's going to kill an Arab. Listen to this just for a moment. On seeing the Arab, the Arab raised himself a little, and his hand went into his pocket. Naturally, I gripped Raymond's revolver in my pocket, my coat pocket, and the Arab let himself sink back again. But without taking his hand from his pocket, I was some distance off, at least 10 yards, and most of the time, all I saw was a blurred, dark form wobbling in the heat haze. Sometimes, however, I had glimpses of his eyes glowing between his half-closed lids. The sound of waves, he's on the beach. The sound of waves was everywhere, skipping down here a little bit. It struck me that all I had to do was turn and walk away and think no more about it. But the whole beach was pulsing with heat, and it was pressing upon my back. I took some steps toward the stream. The Arab didn't move. After all, there was still some distance between us. Perhaps because of the shadow on my face, he seemed to be grinning at me. I waited. The heat began to scorch my cheeks. Beads of sweat were gathering at my eyebrows, and it was just the same sort of heat at my mother's funeral. And I had the same disagreeable sensations, especially in my forehead. All the veins seemed to be bursting through the skin. I couldn't stand it any longer. I took another step forward. I knew it was a foolish thing to do. I wouldn't get out of the sun by moving on a yard or so, but I took that step, just one step forward. And then the Arab drew his knife and held it up toward me athwart the sunlight. This is unbelievable writing. A shaft of light shot upward from the steel, and it felt as a long, thin blade transfixed my forehead, and at the same moment, all the sweat that had accumulated in my eyebrows splashed down upon my eyelids, covering them with a warm film of moisture. Beneath the veil of brine and the tears of my eyes were blinded, and I was conscious only of the symbols of the sun clashing on my skull, and less distinctly of the keen blade of light flashing up from the knife, scarring my eyelashes and gouging into my eyeballs. Then everything began to reel before my eyes. A fiery gust came from the sea, while the sky cracked in two from end to end and a great sheet of flame poured down through the rift. Every nerve in my body was a steel spring, and my grip closed on the revolver. The trigger gave, and the smooth underbelly of the butt jogged my palm, and so, with that crisp whip-crack sound, it had all begun. I shook off the sweat and the clinging veil of light. I knew that I had shattered the balance of the day and the spacious calm of the beach on which I had been happy. But I fired 4 more shots into the inert body, on which they left no visible trace. And each successive shot was another loud, faithful rap upon the door of my undoing. Why do you do that? Camus tells us. For nothing. Okay. So why are you even bringing it up? There's a lot of murder books out there. Albert Camus, one of the great existential philosophers of the 20th century. Now watch this. There's only 2 parts to the book. They're called Part 1 and Part 2. Les deux. And the very end of the book, this priest keeps wanting to talk to him. I don't want to talk to any priest. Finally, he's kind of daydreaming, and in walks a priest with his cassock on and everything. He says, "Can I sit down on the bed?" He sits down on the bed. He says, "Why don't you come here and sit next to me? Let me talk to you." He says, "No." Not because I didn't want to talk to him, or not because I didn't like him or anything. He says, "He seemed like an all right guy, but I just said no." Why didn't you want to talk to me before, the priest says. You know, a lot of guys who are ready to die, by the way, he's ready to die. He's going to be executed for killing this guy for nothing. He said, "I don't want to talk to you." He said, "But a lot of guys who are in this position want to talk to me because I can tell them about God." He goes, "I don't believe in God." He said, "You don't believe in God? Are you sure about that?" He says, "There's a lot of things I'm not sure whether or not I know. And a lot of things I'm not sure whether or not I believe. But what I don't believe, that I know. And I don't believe in God." Now, I've moved you forward in time, friends. We're in the 1930s now, okay? Nietzsche's had his effect. Sartre's had his effect. Evolution's had its effect. All these things have had its effect.